Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We'll talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen, and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we are discussing Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. Born in 1955, she's a pioneering American forensic scientist, genealogist, and entrepreneur who established the field of forensic genetic genealogy. While my daily work deals with the immediate chemical reality of a patient's blood, Colleen's work deals with the deep, inherited code that defines our very identity. She built a bridge that connects a cold case with a name. To understand Colleen's contribution to forensics, you have to understand that she was born into the very history she now protects. Raised in New Orleans, she grew up in a world of living history. She often says she never became a genealogist. She was born one. And while she loved the lore, her brain craved the mechanics. I can relate. As a young girl in the parish Catholic school, she entered science fairs with professional grade focus. One project in particular changed her life. An experiment on the Benham disc, a black and white pattern that creates the illusion of color when spun. That project ended up earning her a scholarship that allowed her to leave New Orleans for Rice University. Eventually, Colleen earned a PhD in experimental nuclear physics from Duke, a field that is dedicated to breaking down the world into its smallest, most energetic parts. For the next 25 years, she did that, and it was a pioneer in a world dominated by men. In 1989, she founded Rice Systems, leading teams that designed the first laser to ever fly on a space shuttle. Her career was defined by high-stakes optics, where she was a problem solver for NASA and the Department of Defense. Her job was literally, "I shine a light on things for a living." She led projects on satellite tracking, training her mind to find a microscopic signal across macroscopic distance. A pivot came in 2005. When the funding for a mission to Jupiter was cut, Colleen found herself at her kitchen table, mourning the end of her physics career and wondering what came next. She doesn't seem like a woman who is used to sitting still. Personally, I suck at that, so I feel her. But in that moment of wondering what her next step was, she looked at a hobby project she'd been writing, forensic genealogy. I told you, women like this always have tons of hobbies. As she was exploring and digging into her own roots, the physicist in her hit a wall. She saw that the tools being used for genealogy and forensics were primitive. She realized the entire forensic community was suffering from a low-resolution problem. They were looking at 20 STR markers and calling it a day, while others were satisfied with matching DNA like a simple barcode. Colleen's background in optics told her that DNA was actually more like a high-resolution map. She recognized that the world was trying to identify bodies using 20th century biology while she was sitting on 21st century physics. To Colleen, the noise of a degraded DNA sample wasn't a dead end. It was just a signal that needed a better laser. So she stopped being a physicist for NASA and started being a physicist for the forgotten. By applying the signal-to-noise ratio she had used for the Department of Defense to the shattered DNA of cold cases, she realized she could give names back to the dead. This realization culminated in her 2005 book, Forensic Genealogy, and it started a quiet revolution that challenged labs to stop looking for a mirror twin and start looking for a family tree. She moved the resolution from DNA to, you know, from just being a simple match tool to a map tool. In the lab, we are trained to be masters of the standard. For decades, the gold standard of forensic identification has been the STR, or short tandem repeat. Think of an STR as a biological stutter. At specific locations on your DNA, a pattern of letters repeats. Maybe it's GATA, GATA, GATA. We look at 13 to 20 of these locations, known as the CODIS markers, to create a genetic barcode. If you have a suspect's blood and a crime scene sample, and those 20 barcodes match, the math is often staggering, often a 1 in a billion probability. It is the perfect mirror tool, but it has a fatal flaw. It only works if you already have the mirror. If the killer isn't in the database, those 20 markers are a dead end. They don't tell you who the person is, they only tell you who they aren't. This is where Colleen's physics mind took us beyond. She pivoted away from the 20 biological stutters and toward the SNP, or single nucleotide polymorphism. A SNP is a single letter change in the genetic code, a C where there's usually a T. Instead of looking at 20 locations, Colleen started looking at 600,000 to 800,000. In our world, that's the difference between a low-resolution thumbnail and a 4K satellite image. The scale is made possible by microarray technology. Instead of the traditional PCR we use to amplify STRs, microarrays use a silicon chip packed with microscopic probes. When the shattered DNA from a cold case is washed over the chip, it binds to these probes, lighting up hundreds of thousands of data points simultaneously. But the real magic isn't just the number of points, it's how they are inherited. This brings us to linkage disequilibrium. In the lab, we know that DNA doesn't just shuffle randomly. It travels in blocks called haplotypes. In the lab, we're used to the paternity test, a simple linear A leads to B calculation. But what Colleen did was essentially a paternity test for a phantom. She looked at a sample and didn't ask who its father was. She asked who its ancestors were. It's a bit futuristic, like something out of a sci-fi novel, but it's also strangely feudal. It's a return to the era where your surname was your destiny and your bloodline was your barcode. To the traditional forensic community, a 1940s plane crash or a 1970s crime scene was often written off as unreadable. But Colleen wasn't just a hobbyist with a new idea. She was a specialist who recognized that unreadable was just a matter of resolution. In a cold case with degraded DNA, the signal is the viable SNPs, and the noise is the bacterial contamination, chemical degradation. Her background in optics allowed her to filter that data until a familial pattern emerged. She looked at the tattered DNA and realized that by treating DNA like a physics problem, she could turn a cold case into a living tree. When Colleen looked at a sample, she wasn't looking for a single match. She was looking for shared chunks of DNA. By measuring these chunks in centimorgans, the unit of genetic distance, she can calculate exactly how closely two people are related. If two people share 3,400 centimorgans, they are parent and child. If they share 200 centimorgans, they might be second cousins. To Colleen, the centimorgan is the unit of distance in a forensic frontier. By utilizing this high-density data, she proved that a single degraded bone fragment could be used like a set of GPS coordinates. You didn't need a direct match. You could triangulate a person's identity through a third cousin twice removed who happened to be curious about their Irish roots. She bridged the gap between the bench scientist and the historian. She turned the laboratory from a place that confirms the suspect into a place that finds one. In the medical lab, we have a specific frustrating label we use for samples that don't meet the mark. QNS, or quantity not sufficient. It's a sticker we put on a tube when there just isn't enough biological data to produce a result. It's the clinical equivalent of a dead end. To the forensic world in the late 1990s, the Northwest Flight 4422 case was defined by this shortfall. In March 1948, when a Northwest Airlines charter carrying 30 merchant marines slammed into Mount Sanford in the Alaskan wilderness, the impact was so violent and the weather so unforgiving that the wreckage was instantly swallowed by a glacier. For over 50 years, those men were part of the mountain. In 1999, the glacier finally yielded. Explorers found a mummified arm and hand, preserved by the sub-zero ice, still clutching a piece of the wreckage. It was a singular biological signal from a tragedy 51 years prior. The military's forensic labs did what they were trained to do. They tried the standard. They attempted traditional STR testing to match the hand to the families of the missing men. But the DNA was too shattered. The biological stutters were too degraded to form a coherent barcode. After years of attempts, the experts officially declared the sample unsolvable. In their eyes, the signal was lost to the noise of the permafrost. However, where the institution saw a QNS failure, Colleen saw the ultimate proof of concept. This wasn't just about finding one man. It was about proving that her new lens could turn a single degraded sample into a searchlight that could scan the entire population. She took this unusable sample and filtered out the 50 years of chemical degradation and bacterial interference to find the specific SNPs that remained. Then she did something totally new. She didn't try to find a direct match for a man. Instead, she used those SNPs to find his cousins. By triangulating the genetic distance, those centimorgans we talked about, between the DNA in that frozen hand and the living descendants in genealogical databases, she narrowed the 30 possible identities down to one specific family tree. Turned out that hand belonged to John Jack Janowski, a 34-year-old merchant marine from Wisconsin. Colleen proved that the standard was the only thing that was insufficient. She treated Jack's DNA like a satellite signal lost in deep space. And because she had the right antenna, she brought him home. This case changed everything. This is the moment the institutional mask of the old school forensic labs started to crack. It proved that genetic genealogy wasn't a niche hobby. It was a high-resolution forensic engine. Before this case, the forensic community looked at genetic genealogy as a candle in the window. Quaint, flickering hobby that might help you find a long-lost great aunt, but certainly wasn't a tool for a high-stakes investigation. However, by identifying Jack Janowski, Colleen proved her theory was actually a searchlight capable of cutting through 50 years of glacial noise to find a single identity in a sea of millions. She didn't just light a candle for the families of Flight 4422. She turned on a star that showed the world that no one is ever truly lost if you have the right math to find them. In 1992 and 1993, Phoenix was haunted by what came to be called the Canal Murders. Two young women, Angela Brasso and Melanie Burness, were brutally killed while riding their bikes along the canal. For over 20 years, their cases sat in a file cabinet. There were no leads. The police department was stumped. They had the killer's DNA from the scene, but no mirror in the CODIS database to match it to. This is where Colleen introduced her new kind of lens, the YSTR, short tandem repeat on the Y chromosome. We know that while most of our DNA recombines or shuffles with every generation, however, the Y chromosome is passed from father to son almost entirely intact. Because the Y chromosome doesn't shuffle, it travels through history as a patrilineal marker that travels with the surname. If you can identify the specific YSTR signature of a crime scene sample, you aren't just looking for a person, you're looking for a family, a last name. Colleen took the unsolvable DNA from the Phoenix canals and filtered its signal until she found the patrilineal signature. She didn't have a suspect, but she had a name. Miller. She told the Phoenix PD that they weren't looking for just anyone. They were looking for a man with the surname Miller. This was a seismic shift for the lab. We moved from being a verification station used solely to confirm a detective suspect to a leads generator telling the detective where to start his search. Think about the audacity of that. She didn't hand the detectives a photo. She handed them a thick old phone book. She told them, go look for a Miller. In a world of high-tech sequencing, she used the most basic identifier we have, the patrilineal surname, to narrow a city of millions down to a single family tree. It's the ultimate laboratory flex, turning a microscopic chemical sequence into a spoken name. You have to wonder, in this world where individuality is king, how many of us are actually family if you go back far enough? I mean, the global population has grown over threefold since World War II, rising from approximately 2.4 billion people in 1950 to over 8 million by 2022. That's a lot of shared roots. However, it wasn't as much of a wild goose chase as it sounded. Once the name Miller was in the air, investigators found Brian Patrick Miller. To the people of Phoenix, Miller wasn't a shadow in the dark. He was a local fixture. He was a well-known figure in the steampunk community, a regular at conventions, and was often seen driving a decommissioned police interceptor modified to look like something out of a post-apocalyptic film. He had a full-blown public persona, the zombie hunter. To the general public, he was a harmless, perhaps slightly eccentric, local celebrity. He wore an elaborate costume, a mask, armor, tactical gear that made him look like a protector in the world of monsters. When the detectives finally brought him in for an interview, they were looking for a brutal, impulsive canal killer. Instead, they found a man who was calm, soft-spoken, and incredibly cooperative. He didn't stutter. He didn't sweat. He just didn't fit the profile that 20 years of FBI criminology had built for this case. In fact, the investigators were so unimpressed that they nearly completely dismissed him as a suspect. Their gut told them that this cosplayer could not possibly be the brutal, cold-blooded canal killer. The police were so convinced that this couldn't possibly be their suspect that they nearly wrote him off entirely. They walked out of that interview room sure that he wasn't their guy. But Colleen's searchlight wasn't looking for his costume or his calm demeanor. It was fixed on the YSTR signature that linked him to the crime scene across two decades. Luckily, the police did decide to follow the scientific protocol anyway, because we've seen way too many unfortunate cases where an officer's gut did the heavy lifting. They had no other leads. They followed Brian to a restaurant, waited for him to finish his meal, and collected his discarded water bottle to test against the profile. It took nearly a decade for the legal system to catch up, but in 2023, Brian Patrick Miller was convicted. His conviction proved that the Y chromosome anchor wasn't just a theory. It was a tool for justice that could see through the most convincing human performance. Colleen's science showed that while a killer can fool a room full of detectives, he can't fool the microscopic signature of his ancestors. Now, it's important to distinguish this from other DNA wins you've heard of. Take the Grim Sleeper. His arrest was the result of a straight-line familial match in a criminal database. It required a relative to already be in the system and an almost match that the investigators looking closely at his relatives. And don't get me started on BTK. That wasn't some triumph of genomic mapping. That was just a guy who didn't understand how a Word document works, whose identity was eventually confirmed by a reverse paternity test on a pap smear. What Colleen did was fundamentally different. He didn't wait for the killer to make a digital mistake or a relative to get arrested. He built a map that made it impossible for them to stay hidden. While Colleen was busy identifying Alaskan crash victims and predicting surnames in Phoenix, the rest of the forensic world was watching. Then, in 2018, the searchlight hit the front page of every newspaper in the world. Joseph James DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer, was arrested after 40 years of evading capture. Investigators didn't find DeAngelo through CODIS. Instead, they used the exact methodology Colleen had pioneered. They took a degraded crime scene sample, ran a high-density SNP profile, and uploaded it to GEDmatch, a public genealogical database. They didn't find an exact match. They found a third cousin. From there, they spent months building reverse trees, starting with the cousin and working backward through births, deaths, and marriages until every branch of that family tree was accounted for, except one, Joseph James DeAngelo. However, this is also where the ethics of science gets complicated. The DeAngelo case proved that this technology was a nuclear option for cold cases, but it also sparked a massive debate in the lab and the legal system. For the first time, people realized that by uploading their spit kit to a genealogy site, they were effectively making their entire extended family searchable by the police. Which is greater, the individual's right to privacy or the public's right to justice? As a result of this debate surrounding the DeAngelo case, genetic databases like GEDmatch changed their terms of service, requiring users to opt in to be included in future law enforcement searches. Colleen's role in this wasn't as the investigator, but as the architect. When the FBI and local task forces needed to know how to navigate a family tree without a direct match, they turned to the principal she had now been teaching for over a decade. She provided the physics that allowed them to see through 40 years of noise. DeAngelo was the proof that the searchlight could find a needle in a haystack of 300 million people. It turned forensic genealogy from a niche lab experiment into a global standard for justice. However, for decades, the forensic world had a filing cabinet problem. Thousands of unidentified remains, Jane and John Doe's, were sitting in cold storage because they didn't have a direct CODIS match. They were the ultimate quantity not sufficient cases. Not because there wasn't enough DNA available, but because there wasn't enough data in the traditional system to match them to a name. To the state, they were biological dead ends. Colleen finally realized that if the state wouldn't build the map to find them, she would have to do it herself. In 2017, Colleen co-founded the DNA Doe Project with Margaret Press. This was a revolutionary nonprofit built on the idea of volunteer collaboration. It wasn't just about the lab work, it was about the searchlight being manned by hundreds of dedicated genetic genealogists, basically crowdsourcing genetic comparisons. The combined power of volunteer collaboration was shining a light on Jane and John Doe's by pooling their collective knowledge of family trees and historical records. They began to do the impossible. They gave the dead back their names, from the buckskin girl to Joseph Augustus Zarelli, who had been known for years only as the boy in the box. The DNA Doe Project proved that no one is truly anonymous if enough people are looking for their signal. While the DNA Doe Project focused on the humanitarian mission of identifying victims, Pauline also founded Identifiers International to handle the heavy technical weight of violent crime. This is her specialized firm where she applies the same nuclear physics precision to active investigations and high-profile cold cases. Identifiers became the special forces of the forensic world. They didn't just run samples. They solve puzzles that the standard labs have given up on. Whether it's a 50-year-old sexual assault or a zombie hunter hiding in a steampunk costume, Identifinders uses the SNP to surname pipeline to drag the truth into the light. At the end of the day, Colleen Fitzpatrick's legacy isn't about the lasers or the 800,000 SMPs. It's about the label. In the lab, we know that an unlabeled specimen is a systemic failure. Colleen spent 25 years at NASA looking at the stars, only to realize that the most important signals she could track were right here on Earth, waiting to be named. Her mission, giving the dead their names back, is the ultimate gift to forensics. She took a clinical, mechanical process and turned it into a restorative act of justice. She proved that, in the right hands, physics doesn't explain the universe. It heals the families left behind in it. Pauline's discovery is a masterpiece of signal processing. She proved to a skeptical world that we could take the shattered noise of degraded, decades-old DNA and find a clear, undeniable signal of identity. To many, this is the gift, a humanitarian miracle that turns the cold, sterile laboratory into a tool of restoration. It is the science that gave a name back to the unknown child of the Titanic and brought final tearful closure to families who had spent 40 years staring at a silent telephone. But every gift of this magnitude carries a trade-off. And in the world of forensics, that trade-off is the loss of individual anonymity in favor of a global genetic database. When a person uploads their DNA profile to a site like GEDmatch or FamilyTreeDNA to find a lost branch of their family tree, they aren't just consenting for themselves. They are effectively loaning out the genetic privacy of their parents, their children, and even their third cousins twice removed. One person's curiosity creates a single, unwitting knot in a global genetic dragnet that no one else in their family signed up for. We can see exactly how the legal and ethical landscape has evolved by looking at how the state moved from targeting a specific individual to casting a line for an entire population. Think back to the hunt for Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. The ethics in that case were surgical, centered entirely on medical privacy. The police didn't scan a crowd. They targeted a specific clinical sample, his daughter's pap smear. The legal shield was the sacred doctor-patient relationship, and the state had to use a specific warrant-based seizure to bypass it. It was a localized, individualized strike. But by 2018, the focus of this debate had shifted completely toward consumer privacy. When the search for the Golden State Killer began, there was no doctor, no clinic, and crucially, no initial warrant for a specific human being. The only thing standing between the state and the identity of Joseph James D'Angelo was the Terms of Service Agreement on a website. Thousands of private citizens essentially became genetic informants for the FBI. Not because they wanted to solve a cold case, but because they wanted to see if a pie chart telling them they were 10% Scandinavian. The searchlight was no longer looking for a suspect, it was looking through everyone else to find one. This is the heart of the science of murder debate. And as a scientist, where the professional friction becomes real. In our world, the laboratory is built on a chain of intent. If we are working at the bench in a hospital and we decide to use a patient's routine glucose test to secretly check for illegal substances without a specific doctor's order, we'd be stripped of our licenses. We don't just run tests because we can. We run them because there's a documented intent. In forensic genetic genealogy, that chain is often severed. These databases were built for one purpose, genealogy. But they were remasked as forensic tools without the users ever knowing the rules of the game had changed. A person's intent was to find a grandfather. The state's intent was to find a strangler. One set of data was being forced to wear two completely different masks, and the chain of intent was left in pieces. It is a testament to Colleen Fitzpatrick's integrity that she was among the first to see this Wild West error for what it was. She didn't want her searchlight to become an instrument of state overreach. She became a vocal advocate for informed consent. Recognizing that for this science to have a permanent home in the justice system, it couldn't operate in the shadows of a terms of service page. As sequencing becomes cheaper and the data becomes more available, the searchlight's only going to get brighter. The question for the next generation of scientists isn't whether we can find anyone, it's whether we have the right to look. In the traditional forensic world, we are often racing against a ticking clock. A case goes cold because a suspect dies, a witness fades, or a biological sample simply doesn't have the direct mirror in a government database. For decades, we operated under the assumption that forensics was limited by the life of the suspect. If the man who committed the crime was gone, the truth was gone with him, like Otis Toole in the Adam Walsh case. But Colleen Fitzpatrick changed the math. She proved that the signal of a crime doesn't end with the perpetrator. Because of her work, forensics is now infinite. It no longer relies on a single individual, but on the DNA of thousands of relatives stretching across generations. She turned the family tree into a forensic map, ensuring that every cousin, every grandparent, and every distant ancestor carries a small piece of the truth. Through her revolutionary breakthroughs, her co-founding of the DNA Doe Project, and the specialized work of Identifiers International, Colleen has identified hundreds of cold case victims and brought the most elusive perpetrators to justice. She took the shattered noise of the past and filtered it until names began to emerge. As a medical laboratory scientist, I see the beauty in that precision. We are taught that an unlabeled specimen is a failure, but Colleen has dedicated her life to fixing that error on a global scale. She didn't just give us a better lens, she gave us a way to see through the mirror of time itself. Colleen Fitzpatrick ensured that for those who commit the unthinkable, time is no longer a shield. It's simply a matter of resolution. If there's one thing I want you to take away from our look at Colleen Fitzpatrick, it's that the impossible is often just a matter of resolution. Colleen taught us that a single degraded sample isn't a dead end. It's a signal waiting for a better antenna. Whether it's identifying a man lost in a glacier for 50 years or pulling a killer out of a steampunk costume, the lesson is clear. The truth is always there, woven into the inherited code of our families. We just have to be willing to look past the mirror and into the trees. Next week, we shift our focus from the pioneer of ancestral DNA to a predator who was finally caught when his own biological and digital labels failed him. We will be diving into the profile of Dennis Rader, the man the world knows as BTK. For 30 years, Rader lived a double life that seemed to defy every rule of criminal profiling, only to be undone by a 21st century digital mistake from a 20th century criminal mind. We will move away from the high-resolution SNP mapping of today's episode and instead look at the clinical reality of a DNA familial match. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to the Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.